You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn and for Rob Ferret today and coming up tonight after 6 on 1A Plus with Jen White. Turning on or tuning out the war in Ukraine. How are your friends and family coping with this latest war, and how can we get some perspective and some peace among the stories and images of wartime? That's tonight after 6 with Jen White right here on the Ideas Network. Now, Starkey Swenson was presumed dead in 1983, and Swenson's case sat unsolved for 38 years. That is until a UW Oshkosh anthropologist and his class took up Swenson's case. They spent last spring and summer digging for his remains in the woods and fields near Omro, and then a breakthrough. They found Swenson's remains, and our guest today is going to tell us more about the Swenson case and how they continue to use anthropology to help solve cold cases in northeastern Wisconsin. And we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. You listen to podcasts or watch TV shows about cold cases? Yeah, they're irresistible. Are you curious about a cold case in your community? And what do you want to know about the work it takes to find human remains and the role anthropologists can play in crime solving? 1-800-642-1234. You can always email us, ideas@wpr.org. Jordan Karsten is with us today. He's an associate professor of anthropology and the chair of the Anthropology, Global Religions, and Culture Department at UW Oshkosh. Jordan and his students are working to solve cold cases in northeastern Wisconsin. And Jordan, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Really appreciate your time this afternoon. And I'd start with just a, you know, give us some idea of what role an anthropologist can play in cold cases.
Well, I mean, I help out with law enforcement across the state whenever they have questions about searching for a clandestine burial. If they've found bones and they don't know if they're human or animal, they'll give me a call to see if I can help. And then if they find human remains, I also will help, you know, try to figure out who that person was. Was it a male or a female? How tall were they? How old were they when they died? Approximately how long has it been since they died? And so we have a lot of skills that we can use to help out law enforcement when they have one of these kind of suspicious death investigations. And so, yeah, I think we can bring a lot to the table.
Hey, Jordan, is this something you expected when you got into anthropology?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I think of myself mostly as an archaeologist.
Yeah.
And so I actually, my archaeological site I did my research on for my PhD is in Western Ukraine. And so some of our work in archaeology is finding things that are buried. Yeah. And so we utilize technology like ground penetrating radar, pedestrian surveys in order to find this, you know, these objects buried in the ground. And then it's our expertise to actually excavate them and do our best to make sure that we recover everything that might be there, right? Even the smallest bone fragment, the smallest artifact. And so by taking those methods, the methods that we use in archaeology and applying them to cold cases where you're looking for clandestine burials, we can really contribute to the effort.
Sifting and winnowing with Jordan Karsten, our guest, associate professor of anthropology at UW Oshkosh. And Jordan, you have a podcast about the work you're doing to solve cold cases. It's called Cold Case of Frozen Tundra. What got you started on this?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I mean, so Winnebago County Sheriff got a hold of me 2 Octobers ago. So October 2020. And they asked if I would be willing to help with the search for the remains of Starkey Swenson. And I didn't know anything about the case at the time. And we went out to a scene in Omro where they had some intelligence to suggest that this individual who was murdered in 1983 was actually buried. And so they wanted me to, you know, use those skills I was just talking about in terms of doing a pedestrian survey, using some remote sensing technology in order to try to figure out if there's something buried in the area. And we went out there and it was a big project. I mean, a big, huge property to really search it kind of comprehensively. And so I got into the case just kind of figuring out what happened. And as I did, I realized that the story of Starkey Swenson's murder was a really interesting story. And it also gave me the idea because podcasts, true crime podcasts, are so popular that by putting one together, you never know for a cold case if somebody hears that you're doing it or chooses to listen, it might just trigger a memory that, you know, that might actually help break open a cold case. And those people might be, you know, they might have the kind of recollection of something that happened in the past, call me, call the investigators, and we might be onto something totally new. And so I figured not only would it be interesting, and not only does Starkey Swenson deserve to have his story told and not forgotten, but it does play this kind of additional role of potentially encouraging people to come forward with information to help break open a cold case. And so that gave me the idea to put a true crime podcast together surrounding the Starkey Swenson disappearance.
And you're getting ready for your next one, and we'll get to that first. But one of the questions I had for you, Jordan, was specifically, you know, how do you do this without, you're dealing with tragedy, and how do you deal with this while protecting those who were traumatized by this tragedy? So when you were dealing with Starkey Swenson and looking for his remains, what was your relationship with the Swenson family?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, before I even got started in the first podcast and looking at Starkey Swenson's case, I talked to law enforcement to say, hey, is this something that would be useful? Is this something that's not going to be harmful to the family and friends of somebody like Starkey Swenson? And they decided that it was a good idea. And as we put it together, I actually became friends with some of Starkey Swenson's family members. And as we actually carried out our search in the Omro area, his family members came out to visit our excavation and our search. And so in terms of my relationship with them, I ended up developing a close relationship with them. And, you know, I think that generally speaking, they appreciated the fact that somebody wanted to take a lot of time to tell the story so it's not forgotten, to put the effort in, to try to make moves on a case that was almost four decades old. And so honestly, the relationships I made with them are relationships I'll keep for the rest of my life.
So this brings us to your next investigation. Jordan Karsten, this is the story of the disappearance of Lori Jean Deppis, who disappeared in 1992.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting case. And for most people in Wisconsin, it is one that people are familiar with. What happened after the Starkey Swenson case is we had a pretty big listenership. Like, we had a lot of people who are tuning into our podcast from the Fox Valley, Green Bay area, and from across Wisconsin. And so I thought to myself, okay, could we, you know, focus this in with our listeners on another case? And if we do, we still stand the chance of, you know, triggering these old memories and getting someone to come forward with new information. And so we decided to look for another case that we could do, and we found the case of Lori Deppis, who actually went missing from the Fox River Mall back in the early 1990s. And so I talked to the investigators who were in charge of the case. They got in touch with the family. We got everybody on board. You know, I wasn't going to do it if the investigators and the family didn't think that this was a good idea. And everybody thought that it was a good idea, especially heading into the 30th anniversary of her disappearance. And so we're in the process of researching and putting together our episodes outlining the cold case and the disappearance of Lori Deppis.
Our guest, Jordan Karsten, Associate Professor of Anthropology at UW-Oshkosh. Your calls at 1-800-642-1234. We're Jake and Appleton standing by. Good afternoon, Jake. Jake, are you there? Looks like we're going to miss out on Jake. So let's take a moment here. But to reiterate, if you've got a question for Jordan, 1-800-642-1234. And what might you know about the disappearance of Lori Deppis back in 1992 from the Fox River Mall? We'll continue the conversation with our guest, Jordan Karsten, Associate Professor of Anthropology and the Chair of the Anthropology, Global Religions, and Culture Department at the UW-Oshkosh as we continue on these cold cases here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and we're continuing our talk about how anthropology can be used to solve cold cases here in Wisconsin. Jordan Karsten, Chair of the Anthropology Department at UW-Oshkosh, stays with us, and now Delaney Rickles joins us. Delaney is an anthropology student at UW-Oshkosh. She worked with Jordan in the search for Starkey Swenson's remains. Delaney, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I really appreciate your time this afternoon. And just so, tell us a little bit about your experience on the search for Starkey Swenson's remains and what that work was like for you as an anthropology student at UW-Oshkosh.
Well, I worked on it back in October of 2020 as well. And for me there, I was mainly metal detecting and trying to see if there was anything in the woods that we ended up excavating. And got a lot of scratches from all of the trees and bushes that we had to climb through.
Yeah, so
Delaney got the bad jobs, unfortunately. she's a real trooper,
which is why we invited her here this afternoon. So Delaney, tell us a little bit about what this field work looks like. You know, when you go out there to do this, as you mentioned, you get all the scratches and scrapes. What are some of the tools you need? What's the site like? Give us the lay of the land.
Oh man, the lay of the land. Well, when we first went, it was full of trees and bushes and like the really awful ones that have little thorns. And so those were awful. Once we got there, though, in the summer with the whole class, we were lucky enough to have all of the main landscape kind of plowed down so we'd be able to dig. But other than that, I mean, the main tools we use were like shovels, trowels, and buckets.
And what would you think, what would you say was the most difficult part or period of this investigation into the remains of Starkey Swenson, Delaney?
Oh, the hardest part probably was like not knowing if we were going to find him or not. Because mm-hmm. a lot of us were putting so much like time and effort into helping this family. And when you like sit down and think about it, you get really worried that you're not going to be able to solve it for them in the end.
Yeah. Yeah. So this Starkey Swenson case, it's from the early 80s. But this was a case, as I understand, Jordan Karsten, where the person had committed to the murder, but we just did not have the Starkey's remains. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the story itself is really interesting. And of course, I encourage people who are interested to listen to the podcast.
Yeah.
But it's what happened was in the early 90s, a man named John Andrews was convicted of Starkey's murder. He actually pled an Alford plea, which allowed him to maintain his innocence, and he ended up sentenced to homicide by negligent use of a motor vehicle. And so, I mean, very technically speaking, the case was over and solved. The issue was that Starkey Swenson himself had never been found. Mm-hmm.
So the chance to heal and to find some closure for the Starkey Swenson family. But now you're looking into this cold case of missing woman, Lori Depis. And so let's start with what we know about Lori Depis at this point, Jordan, and how this investigation moves forward for you.
Yeah, I mean, the case itself is it's another one that grabs your attention. I mean, Lori was this young woman working at the Fox River Mall in the 1990s. When malls were basically like downtowns, and she left one evening after closing her store, shows up at her boyfriend's house, and they hear her drive in because she had a loud muffler, but she never comes to the door. And when they go downstairs, a group that was there kind of gathered for a social evening, they see that her car is locked, that a soda cup sitting on the roof of her car, and there's no sign of Lori Depis. And that's basically where, in a lot of ways, the case leaves off. I mean, it's gone down a lot of different kind of investigative paths, including serial killers. And so I think telling the story as accurately as possible, not going into things that are kind of fantastical. I mean, just the facts and trying to stick to it and laying it out there for people where it might encourage people to come forward to give us some information to help with this case. That's the goal.
Delaney Rinkle, as an anthropology student, were you expecting to be involved in solving crimes?
Oh, no. Not even a little bit.
But once you were, I mean, did that change the way you saw what your field of study could be and could do?
Oh, definitely. It was one of those things that I tried in like the summer of 2020 with Jordan, but I didn't realize what you could use anthropology for as much. And then when we started doing that, it was like, oh, okay, kind of dig this. I could do this. And he just keeps finding new cases that I volunteer to.
So yes, will you be involved in the search for Lori Depis?
Oh my gosh, I have to be. I would be upset. Well,
Delaney's, as she said, she digs it, but she's actually a very good digger. And so she's... So as long as I can keep her around, I will, because she's great at excavating and a nice, good, careful excavator, even though I tend to give her some of the hardest jobs.
Well, Jordan, yeah, you'd mentioned this, that you're looking for everything. And when you're looking for everything from something that can be 30 plus years old, it could be as much as dust at this point. So Delaney, as an anthropology student, how do you discriminate some dust that doesn't matter from some dust that just might?
Oh, I have to ask so many questions.
Yeah.
From Jordan specifically. Like when we were digging for in Almro, there was all of these rocks that were just so close to bone colored that pretty much every single one, I was like, I know this is a rock.
But
I need to verify if this is a rock because it's just a little weird, the color, the shape.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you're going through every piece to try to identify whether or not it's relevant to your investigation. That's every piece out in the middle of thorns and bushes and shrubs and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's not to mention that Wisconsin is full of these glacial rocks. And so while we would dig, you know, we would sift through the earth and we would come up with these rocks.
Oh.
And that throws people for a little bit of a loop. And, you know, we give them in-class training for human osteology, the study of the human skeleton. But when you're in the field, I mean, the pressure is on,
right?
Because you don't want to misidentify something.
Hmm. So you set up the disappearance of Lori Deppis, coming home from the Fox River Mall or going to her boyfriend's apartment in the Fox River Mall, but never evidently going inside as far as we know. So where does that leave an anthropologist to begin looking 30 years later?
Well, I think the issue comes down to, are there credible leads in terms of where somebody potentially disposed of her? And it's not a pleasant thing to think of, but if there are credible leads, then we can help in terms of making that search happen. And it is relying on things like pedestrian survey. It is relying on students who can recognize human skeletal elements. It is relying on technology like ground penetrating radar in order to try to comprehensively search for places that at least are potentially of interest.
By the way, we've got a link to the podcast up at WPR.org/Central Time where you can find it anytime. And part of this conversation, Jordan and Delaney, is to ask our audience whether or not they have any knowledge of or might have any information pertaining to the disappearance of Lori Deppis. It's a story that got a lot of attention 30 years ago, but this is 30 years later. What can you expect to find?
Well, I mean, honestly, we've had since we announced that we were going to undertake this kind of research and put out a podcast focused on her case and her story, we've had a lot of people come forward and they've reached out to me, they've reached out to law enforcement. And so, you know, that is the goal. We don't know what we're going to find. I mean, the thing is, you never know if you've got some kind of connection to this case or you have some information that you might even think is trivial, it might not be. I mean, on some of these cold cases, the smallest piece of information that somebody might think doesn't matter, it might be the difference between, you know, having a successful search and not. And so, you know, I urge people who think they have any kind of, you know, information that might be relevant to come forward.
Delaney Rickle is a UW Oshkosh college student. As you look at anthropology and what it teaches you, where do you see yourself going? Where would you like to go from your education?
That's like the age-old question.
Mm-hmm.
In a perfect world, I would love to go to graduate school and get a degree in biological anthropology, similar to what Jordan did.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I mean, really lucky, it'd be cool to do like forensic anthropology as a job. That would be like...
Yeah.
Top tier.
Well, how many forensic anthropologists are actually out there? Yeah.
There's a reasonable number of people who work in the field. Many people are professors, but there are people who work for, you know, medical legal institutions, medical examiner's offices, you know, for coroners, this kind of thing, the defense department. So they are there, but yeah, it does require some advanced education.
Absolutely. But as we look towards at what you're going to do next, Jordan Karsten, is there a timeline for this podcast? Can you possibly give us some idea of what to expect where we start a few episodes and see where it goes, or, what are we looking at here?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so we are, number one, processing some of the information that's coming into us from people across Wisconsin and actually across the United States. And we're also talking to folks and we're putting these episodes together and they will be out this spring. We'll have episodes starting to be released before the summer, guaranteed.
Wow. All right. And we've got a link up again at WPR.org/Central Time. And you said you've already got leads that you are looking at. Are you doing any digging or looking towards any sites to dig as the our frozen tundra begins to thaw?
Yeah, not quite yet. I mean, we have some ideas that we have already based on some information. So I guess the best thing I can say is stay tuned, because I think I sincerely hope that we have some credible leads to follow.
And does Delaney join you on the podcast? Will we hear her voice at any time?
It's probably time for her to, don't you think, Delaney?
She's got some practice now.
Yeah, right? Maybe. We'll think about it.
Well, Jordan, I want to thank you for sharing your podcast and your work with us this afternoon. Delaney, I want to thank you both for joining us and looking forward to hearing what you have come this spring.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
You bet. That's Jordan Karsten, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Anthropology, Global Religions and Culture at UW-Oshkosh. And also Delaney Rickle, Anthropology student at UW-Oshkosh. Jordan and Delaney joined us to talk about using anthropology to solve cold cases in northeastern Wisconsin. And a reminder, a link to their podcast is available at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, by the way, tomorrow's Friday, that makes it Food Friday, and that means beautiful, tasty, dreamy, yeasty carbohydrates. Oh yeah, it's Food Friday, and we're going to be baking with the authors of Artisan Bread in 5 minutes a day. 5 minutes a day for that? Well, got to find out. That's tomorrow. Also tomorrow, what to do with the artesian wells in Bayfield County. That's where a Duluth-based company is suing for the right to bottle and sell the underground water collected on the land that they own in Bayfield County. Whose water is it? We'll find out. Central Time tomorrow. Join us from 3 to 6 here on the Ideas Network. Also, late word in, just in, Representative Mark Pocan will also join the show tomorrow afternoon to talk about a new congressional spending bill. That's here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, funding Wisconsin schools beyond complicated spending formulas and seemingly never-ending referenda. More schools are selling naming rights and sponsorships to businesses for a more direct revenue stream, but is it enough? Is this part of the future of school funding? You tell me. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Herbst. A senior defense official says the Pentagon sees no evidence that Russia is sending more troops into Ukraine. The official estimates that Russia has fired more than 775 missiles at Ukrainian targets, relying on long-range weapons in the wake of a sluggish start by ground forces. The Russian military continues to advance on Kyiv with stiff resistance from Ukrainian forces. State Department spokesman Ned Price says the U.S. continues.
It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we know now that Wisconsin Legislative Special Counsel Michael Gableman has a contract to continue his investigation into the 2020 presidential election. But a judge in one of the open records lawsuits against the special counsel says their documents reveal not much of an investigation, at least so far. But first, funding for school districts in Wisconsin. It's been a hot-button political issue for decades, and it's been exacerbated in recent years by declining enrollment and now the pandemic. So some Wisconsin school districts have turned to private sponsorships and naming rights to help pay for athletic facilities and programs. Perhaps you've seen them. While others have received charitable donations that help fund capital projects for academics, perhaps you've heard about them. It raises some ethical questions about whether private businesses should be allowed to have their branding advertised on public school facilities, or if it's a harmless way to provide more funding at a time when schools are looking for just that. Be interested in knowing and hearing from you. Our guest today researches school funding in Wisconsin and the challenges our system faces. What do you think? 1-800-642-1234. Do you see a problem with private businesses sponsoring public school, field, gym, or pavilions? What kind of restrictions do you think there should be over private sponsorships at schools across Wisconsin? Got a couple comments up on Facebook, on our Ideas Network Facebook page that we'll get to, and you can always comment there or call us now at 1-800-642-1234. Andrew Rushofsky is a professor emeritus of public affairs and applied economics at the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let's start with some basics. I know this is a complicated formula, or there are complicated formulas, plural, but to give us an overview of funding for public schools in Wisconsin, you're the expert. How does it look from 10,000 feet up?
Well, I might start by saying that I and many people who look at school funding in Wisconsin think that the system is broken, doesn't work well. And basically, we fund schools with a mixture of local property tax revenues and revenues from state aid and a little bit of federal revenues. And one thing that characterizes Wisconsin's school funding system that you don't find, I think, in any other state, is that the state has imposed a revenue limit on schools. And it's a revenue limit that is the sum of what is called general state aid, most of 80% of total state funding for schools, plus property tax revenues. And this was instituted in 1994. And in the first decade or so, the amount that districts could raise, and that's effectively spend, went up by about the rate of inflation. But in the last decade or so, that annual adjustment, as it's called, has, in one case, it went negative, and in recent years, including the current budget, it is absolutely zero. So that means that any increase in state aid has to be offset with a reduction in property taxes. And the bottom line is that schools end up with no extra revenue, despite the fact that the costs of education continue to rise.
Andrew, some school districts now have turned to naming right sponsorships from private businesses to help fund their athletics facilities. How recent of a phenomenon is this?
I'm not exactly sure, but I think this kind of phenomenon has been going on in various states for a number of years. Schools across the country facing constraints in terms of public funding have looked for donations from individuals, donations from businesses, voluntary contributions. And that's been going on, I think, for decades. And maybe there's an upsurge now in naming rights, but I'm not actually sure.
Article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel recently detailing some of the naming rights that have been sold off in Wisconsin schools across the state. And Andrew, what sort of regulations do we see on these sort of naming rights and sponsorships at public schools?
That's a good question, and I don't really know the answer. It's obviously the answer is different in Wisconsin and in other states. As far as I know, there are not any state regulations for local districts to decide to give naming rights as a way of generating revenue.
Do we know what sort of revenue it generates? Are there big dollars behind these names?
As far as I know, the state does not collect data on naming right revenue. They do collect data on revenue that districts generate from selling ticket sales and miscellaneous sources of revenue. And on the whole, those miscellaneous revenues across the whole state and across all school districts account for a few percent at most of total revenues of school districts. So it's not an important source of funding in the broader picture, although for an individual district that's struggling to educate its children, being able to improve facilities by gaining some revenue or a naming right for an existing facility, which then allows that revenue to be used for general education, even if it's a small amount relative to the total budget of schools, it can make a big difference.
Andrew Rashofsky is a professor emeritus of public affairs and applied economics at the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs in UW-Madison, looking at alternatives to funding sources for schools across Wisconsin and the rise in reports of naming rights and sponsorships we've seen at Wisconsin schools and whether or not it's something you would support at your local school at 1-800-642-1234. And we have a comment here, as mentioned before, on Facebook. Paul writes on our Facebook page, our Ideas Network Facebook page,
I think it shows clearly our tax policies are wildly out of whack. We shouldn't be depending upon corporate charity to provide services guaranteed by the state's constitution. Any company with enough profit to buy a community, a school, should be paying more in taxes so working families don't have to carry that whole burden. Andrew, what's your reaction to Paul's thought on this?
I think I generally agree with Paul that states have a responsibility, and the foundation of that is in the state constitution. There's an education clause, and across the country, in fact, courts, not in Wisconsin, have argued that states are responsible for providing what generally is called an adequate education for all their students. And arguably, that's not happening in Wisconsin. And that doesn't prevent some school districts from saying if they want to have an extra fancy sports facilities to look for private funding. But it is worrisome when school districts are forced to go after private corporate funding as just a way of maintaining basic education.
Lynn from our Facebook page said, if businesses want to support a school project with a donation, that's great, but we don't need to give them a permanent advertising by putting their names on buildings or fields. A brass plaque should be sufficient. And I guess that would go to the heart of what individual districts decide what works for themselves when it comes to sponsorship or naming rights in these schools, Andrew.
I think it's a decision that we should allow local school districts to make. It's unfortunate they're in a situation where they are desperate for revenue, but if a donor comes and is willing to contribute substantial amount of money, and the price for that is putting their name on some facility, whether it's a plaque or a big sign, that's given the circumstances, that's probably all right.
So another comment from our Facebook page as they come in, the Ideas Network Facebook page, a little lively this afternoon with our Central Time topic, also calls at 1-800-642-1234. Here's what Joan had to say. We've had two insurance companies donate to update or build new portions of the high school. Other than their names over the door, we've not seen any or heard any undue influence. This was a win for the taxpayers. And, you know, when you talk about the imposed revenue limit on schools that came down in Wisconsin in 1994, that was supposed to be a win for the taxpayers, too. Are the taxpayers being protected through this in some way, Andrew, as you see it?
I think basically no. And let me try to explain why not. The way the revenue limit works is there's a limit on total general aid and property tax revenue. So the state, as it did in the current budget that we're living through now, the biennial budget, it increased general aid, but it didn't change at all the revenue limit. And that forces districts to cut their property tax levy. But how do they do that? The only way they can do that is by lowering the rate. And think about what that does. Lowering the rate means that you pay somewhat lower property taxes, but every owner of property within the school district also pays lower property tax. And that includes owners of vacation property who don't live in the state. It includes businesses. They could be a business that's incorporated in Europe, foreign businesses or in other states. We spread out property tax relief. The term that I use is untargeted. It goes to absolutely every owner of property. And the larger the value of your property, the larger the tax break you get. As a net result, the proportion of property tax breaks that goes to homeowners, particularly to homeowners who face a high burden, pay a lot of taxes relative to their income, presume taxpayers that we might as a state want to assist, get a fairly small share of the total tax break that's effectively mandated through revenue caps. So it's not a very successful way of giving property tax relief. And we've been following this approach for years. And in the end, you might think that, oh, property tax revenues in school revenues in Wisconsin must be lower than the national average. But in fact, they're still above the national average, although they've come down.
Huh. We're talking to UW Madison Professor Emeritus Andrew Rashofsky about school district funding in Wisconsin and the role of donations and sponsorships. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-123. Had a couple of comments on our Ideas Network Facebook page where you can join the debate there. Do you think private business sponsorships should be treated differently than donations to school districts? And would you be okay with more advertising and naming rights if it reduced the need for a referendum every year? Do you have any ethical concerns about businesses putting their names on public school facilities? And do you think students care? 1-800-642-1234. Number to join our conversation with Andrew Rashofsky is 1-800-642-1234. Conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and we're picking up the conversation with Andrew Rashofsky, Public Affairs Professor and Emeritus from UW-Madison, on how Wisconsin can fund schools, how Wisconsin does fund schools, and how Wisconsin should fund schools. And we're interested in hearing from you still before our time is up at 1-800-642-1234. What kind of changes would you like to see for school funding in Wisconsin? As we continue here, Andrew, I do want to ask about referenda, which come, for school districts, it comes around quite often, and it is a call for extra additional funding from school districts that can't find it, as in part as a result of the imposed revenue limits on schools. It dates back to 1994. What do you, in terms of school funding, how do you view referenda?
Well, referenda are a way of, and really the only way, for school districts and citizens within school districts to override the revenue limit, to say, okay, we are willing to pay higher property taxes to increase spending on our schools. And process has existed since 1994. And one interesting thing are that the proportion of districts that are going to referenda has been increasing, and the proportion of successful referenda has increased over time. And I think that reflects the desperation that so many districts face in how do we provide education for our children. In some cases, they face rising costs, but they are unable to spend more money, not even adjustments for inflation. And in some sense, thank goodness for having referenda, at least it allows some districts to spend more money. But the evidence shows it's much easier for districts that are relatively small, often high-income districts, to enact and successfully pass referenda than big districts with substantial amounts of low-income and diverse populations. And so over time, it counteracts the effort of state aid to equalize funding and provides more inequalities in the funding of education within a state.
And as we've been talking about school funding here, I would be remiss if we did not bring up private schools and how they factor into the complications of funding formulas for education in Wisconsin. So, Andrew, do private schools have the same types of restrictions for outside funding as part of the Wisconsin Department of Instruction? Or would they, in theory, be allowed to, well, say, sell sponsorships, take donations for anything?
As far as I know, private schools are not subject to any constraints and restraint on their ability to raise revenue. And if you like at universities also, you go around and buildings have people's names of donors, classrooms have names. And so the reliance on private donations from individuals and from businesses in the private sector is even greater than the public sector.
One example in Beloit, Diane Hendricks and other business leaders there formed a nonprofit organization, Kids First Beloit, that then funded a new public charter school called the Lincoln Academy to compete with the school district of Beloit. So with that in mind, Andrew, what kind of ways are there for private citizens and organizations to work around some of these school funding challenges that we've been seeing?
In part, one might argue that if you care about the funding, if you care about public education in Wisconsin, and you want to improve the funding and the equity in funding of public education, one, as a private citizen, ought to be lobbying our legislature to try to fix what is essentially a broken system. Failing that, if you don't think that your school district or your children or your neighbor's children go to school have enough resources, I think people can try to donate, try to help out.
Why work to fix?
Is that going to make a big difference? Yeah. Probably not.
Well, why you talk about, and you know, we started with how the funding formula is, and your as from your research is broken for Wisconsin education, and it needs to be fixed. But what about the argument that you know, maybe starting from scratch or starting from a different place altogether? I mean, what do you see in your studies, Andrew, that would work going forward? Where do we begin to find some equity here, and where do we begin to find a way to pay for the future of Wisconsin?
So I talked about, and we've been discussing, the revenue limits, which place an incredible constraint on school districts. And the pattern of spending that we saw in 1994 has sort of been frozen over time, more or less. And we've frozen in inequity. So that's one issue. But the other issue is the way that we distribute state aid, general aid equalization formula. Our formula in Wisconsin takes account to a good degree of the property wealth of different districts, but it pays almost no attention to the fact that some districts have to spend more money to educate their kids than other districts. And that reflects, on the one hand, small rural districts where have few students but still have to provide a whole array of education. And on the other hand, that different compositions of student bodies generate different costs. So a school district that has lots of students who don't come to school speaking English and lots of students from low-income families have to spend a lot more money to achieve any educational standard than a district that has middle and upper middle class students who come to school already prepared, whose parents can buy them computers and school supplies and so forth. And our formula takes almost no account of differences in poverty, for instance. And that's in striking contrast to most other states, which have used various means, including weighted pupils. So if you have students from low-income families, they count as, let's say, a student and a half, giving more state aid to those districts that have concentrations of what we might call high-need students. And we don't do that in Wisconsin.
Andrew Rashofsky is a professor emeritus of public affairs and applied economics at the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Ben in La Crosse is standing by. Ben, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Hi. Couple of points. One of them is prior to the 1994 change in the legislation, school boards could enact whatever taxes they wanted on their districts. And we had a situation where property taxes, the school portion of property taxes was going up 10% or more per year, year over year. It was a problem that legislation was designed to solve. Secondly, the issue of who pays the property taxes is because the situation is inequitable because residential property owners wind up paying approximately 75% of all property taxes in the state because special interests have lobbied to get their property tax burden reduced. Thirdly, it's a situation where as enrollment goes up, the costs go up for education in a school district. But apparently as enrollment goes down, which is what's happening throughout the state, costs continue to go up.
Ben, we're short on time, and I appreciate the 3 points, but I want to give enough time for Andrew to respond. Andrew?
Those are complicated issues. Just let me say that they are ways to limit and constrain growth in property tax revenue that are not as draconian as our current revenue limits that have lots of unintended consequences.
Do you see any momentum for funding changes on education in Wisconsin, Andrew?
I hope so. I think what's happening over time is that more people around the state, and this is rich districts, poor districts, conservative and liberal political areas, are all saying, wait a minute, we don't have enough funding for our schools. And this is becoming a crisis across the state in all sorts of districts. And that's a probably prerequisite for the political momentum to think about reform.
Andrew, really appreciate you joining us today. Thank you.
Sure, my pleasure.
Andrew Ushofsky, Professor Emeritus of Public Affairs and Applied Economics at the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. With us today to look at how we fund our schools and how that may change or stay the same. Coming up after the news, 700 pages released from the Wisconsin Legislative Special Counsel's investigation into the 2020 presidential election, and the judge in this open records case is challenging the public to find evidence of any investigation within these newly available documents. That's next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
I used to push for a diplomat.